Hello everyone. Is that sound working okay for everyone?
Yes.
Well, thanks very much for the opportunity to speak to you today. I'm going to be using mainly word of mouth, but I do have just a few slides which I'll come to in due course just to illustrate a few of the key points. But I've taken as my subject, as you can see, the evolving risk environment. As you know, the Reserve Bank has a long-standing mandate to promote financial stability. The way we think about that mandate, how it fits into the wider central banking framework, and how it fits in with the work of the other financial regulators are all large topics in themselves, which I'm not going to go into today. But for today, I simply note that one of the ways that we do our work in this area is by providing regular analysis of financial system risks, and particularly through our half-yearly financial stability review. We do that partly to inform the policy debate, but also because it's important that lenders and investors like yourselves be well informed about the risk environment so that they can make good judgments about the risks that they choose to accept. As investors in the share market, you'd be well aware that investment is a risky activity. In the early part of this year, we've seen some significant falls in equity prices, and we've seen higher volatility in equity markets around the world and in other markets as well, most notably including some big falls in international oil prices. There's no shortage of commentators around the place offering interpretations of these events and making predictions about what might follow. I'm not going to be offering those sorts of predictions today. Instead, I think the way that I can best contribute to your thinking about these things is to try and place them in the wider context of the evolving financial risk environment over the past few years. In many ways, the current financial situation continues to be shaped by the aftermath of the global financial crisis. The epicentre of that crisis is usually dated back to the collapse of Lehman Brothers, which was in September 2008, and the recovery that we've had since then started about 6 months later, so that's around March 2009. On that basis, we've been in a period of global recovery, coming up now to about 7 years. It's useful just to think about the general contours of that. In broad outline, this has been a period marked by a return to reasonably solid growth in world GDP at rates either around trend or not much less than that. There's been widespread but somewhat varied progress in balance sheet repair in banking institutions around the world and, generally speaking, improved conditions in global financial markets. All of those things have been positive developments, and they represent a substantial cumulative improvement since the height of the crisis. And it's important to keep that perspective in mind, I think, when interpreting shorter-term fluctuations in market sentiment. All of that said, there are a number of qualifications that I should make to the summary picture that I've just given you. First of all, growth around the world during this recovery period has been uneven geographically. China and other emerging economies initially led the way, while Europe tended to lag. More recently, that configuration has been changing, with Asian growth softening and Europe looking a bit firmer. The US, throughout the period, has been achieving fairly steady growth. Another qualification is that labour market slack still exists in some areas of the global economy, especially in parts of Europe. Global debt levels remain high, and the recovery period has been marked by periodic bouts of nervousness in financial markets, including the one that we're just seeing now. And I'll have some more to say about that a bit later. One general indicator that things are still some way short of normality is the level of global interest rates, still at exceptionally low levels around the world to support growth. This remains the case notwithstanding the much heralded rise in the US federal funds rate at the end of last year. An obvious question that arises from all of this is, why has the recovery from the 2008-2009 recession taken so long? And I suggest there are two important factors at work to help explain that. The first factor is that the GFC period involved more than one crisis. It began in the US mortgage market in 2007, and it spread through various channels of contagion to banks and financial institutions in other parts of the world, especially the euro area and the UK. So that was the initial crisis, triggered by poor asset quality and excessive leverage. But even while the US was recovering from that, there was a second crisis developing in Europe, and that was a crisis of confidence in the sustainability of the euro area as a single currency area. At different times, a number of the weaker economies in the area have come under scrutiny as to whether they'd be able to meet their obligations, and there have been particular concerns focused on Greece in key periods. These episodes led to strains in financial markets, increases in risk pricing, and they weighed heavily on confidence and on the pace of recovery. With the euro area accounting for just under a sixth of the global economy, this in turn acted as a significant drag on global growth. So that's the first factor, more than one crisis. The second factor is that other things equal, history suggests that recovery from financial crises typically take longer than recoveries from more conventional types of business cycle downturns. It takes time to repair balance sheets, time to reduce excessive leverage, time to unwind asset market imbalances, and time to reverse the damage that a crisis can have on trust and confidence. One important recent study found that the average duration of impact from financial crises across a range of countries and over a period of two centuries, the average impact period has been around 5 years. And since the current crisis episode has been more severe than most, it's not surprising that the after effects have lasted even longer than that. An amplifying factor too has been the international dimension. When a financial or a banking crisis occurs in a single economy or in a small group of economies, exchange rate depreciation is often part of the market response and part of the recovery mechanism. There are a lot of examples of that in recent decades. But there's obviously much less scope for that mechanism to work when a crisis is affecting large parts of the global economy simultaneously, because everybody can't devalue against everyone else. Taken together, I think these factors go a long way towards explaining the drawn-out nature of the global recovery to date, even though, as I said, economic conditions in recent times have been much better than they were a few years ago. Policymakers around the world have been responding to this situation on a number of fronts. Interest rates were reduced to near zero or even slightly below zero in some cases, in many advanced economies, to support recovery and to promote balance sheet repair. In Europe, significant institutional reforms are being made to strengthen the stability of the euro area, and these are aimed at getting banking and crisis management arrangements across the area to function in a more unified way that makes them more robust to shocks in the future. Globally, there's an extensive program of financial reform underway, for example, in banking and in securities regulation, all of that aimed at building resilience in our financial systems, and Australia has been very much part of the process of designing and implementing those reforms. A related development in this period is that there's been a renewed interest in more proactive approaches to management of systemic risk. Partly that reflected the lesson from the GFC itself, that financial crises are costly, and so there's a strong need for better risk management. In keeping with that, institutional arrangements have been strengthened in some jurisdictions to support more proactive risk management by supervisors where that was found to be lacking in the lead-up to the crisis. A related point is that in a low interest rate environment, supervisors have seen a need to be particularly vigilant against a build-up of risk in interest-sensitive sectors. And so a number of them have been taking measures in recent times to respond to developing risks often focused on property lending. And that's another subject that I'll say a bit more about later on. But to summarise and perhaps oversimplify the picture somewhat, the after effects of the GFC on the global economy have included an extended period of low interest rates, search for yield behaviour by investors in some interest-sensitive sectors, and a strengthened focus on risk management by prudential regulators. Now, with all of that as background, I want to turn to some more recent developments. And it's useful to take that in three parts, namely the global risk environment, possible implications of that environment for Australia, and then what are the domestically generated sources of risk. So first of all, the global risk environment. Prior to the current bout of market volatility, our most recent financial stability review, which was published late last year, noted that there was an improvement in conditions going on in Europe and a general shift in the focus of risk towards emerging economies. In Europe, this trend seemed to reflect, at least in part, a greater degree of confidence in Europe-wide institutions. The European authorities, as I've said, have taken a number of actions over recent years to alleviate financial system risks, including increased support from the ECB and ongoing progress in unifying the system of banking regulation. Excuse me. And we're seeing some of the results of that. And here I'll start with my first chart. So more generally, we can see that the condition of the European financial sector has now started to improve. And one summary indicator of that is the level of non-performing loans in the banking system. So essentially, if a bank makes a loan and there's some reason to expect it not to be repaid in full, for example, if the loan is overdue, it counts as a non-performing loan, and you can express that as a proportion of the loans outstanding. I think this chart summarises in quite an effective way the quite divergent experiences of different economies around the world when the GFC hit. You can see from this that the banking system in the euro area was hit just as hard as in the UK and in the US, but it's been quite a bit slower to recover. But the point that I wanted to make from this slide is that we are now starting to see some gradual improvement in the last couple of years. Balance sheets are starting to strengthen, bank profitability is increasing, and banks have been able to start to make some increases in their lending. So those are hopeful signs, but we have to recognise that Europe still has a long way to go in its post-crisis financial sector recovery, and some of the earlier concerns have resurfaced again in the recent market turmoil that we've seen this year. So that's Europe. At the same time, and referring back to what we said in our review last year, we noted that financial stability risks in China have been building. The Chinese economic expansion over recent years has been associated with increasing debt, strong asset price growth, and apparent overinvestment in some parts of the economy in some regions. And one summary indicator of that is illustrated in this next slide, which shows the amount of private sector debt expressed as a percentage of national income. You can see that China, amongst the economies shown here, is at the top end of the experience, and that debt ratio has been rising, currently sitting on about 200% of GDP. Now, as we all know, the Chinese economy is in the process of slowing. That's a normal experience for an economy as it becomes more advanced and gets closer to the frontier of the high-income economies. It's normal for growth to slow, but that process does carry risks and uncertainties depending on the speed and extent of the slowdown. In our report, we noted that if growth were to slow further from recent high rates, past excesses might be exposed because leverage is always harder to manage in a slower growth environment. These risks are hard to assess, and the Chinese authorities do have many levers that they can pull to support growth and financial stability, particularly when you recognise the ongoing large role of the state in the Chinese economy, the fact that they still had a heavily regulated financial system, and the presence of capital account controls. So as I said, these things are uncertain, and if I can paraphrase something that the Chinese central bank governor said recently, he said that the central bank is not God or a magician that can turn uncertainties into certainties. Outside China, country-specific risks also seem to have been increasing in a number of other emerging market economies, for example, Brazil, Russia and Turkey. Among the varying factors contributing to that have been falling commodity prices, political instability and concerns over excessive corporate leverage. And in response, equity prices and exchange rates in these economies have generally fallen quite sharply. Now, all of those trends that I've just described were already evident through the course of last year, and together with the general GFC background that I've also talked about, they form part of the background to the nervousness that we've seen in financial markets in the early part of 2016. As I said at the outset, the early part of this year has seen significant volatility, especially in equities and in some commodity prices. I'll show you a chart showing you the extent of some of that. The broad equity price indices have fallen by about 10% in the United States since the start of the year, about 15% in Europe, and by about 20% in China. Those falls have been accompanied by further large falls in prices of some commodities, and especially oil, continuing declines that they'd recorded over the previous couple of years. In the case of oil, for example, it's recently been trading at less than $30 a barrel, whereas 2 years ago it was well over $100 a barrel. From a financial stability perspective, these developments raise a number of important questions. To what extent, if any, are these price movements interrelated, and in what way? And what, if anything, do they tell us about the evolving risk environment? And particularly, what's the link between oil and equities that's attracted so much attention in recent weeks? It's in the nature of these things that definitive interpretations are rarely possible, and certainly not in real time. At this stage, a number of possible hypotheses might be put forward. The combination of lower equity and lower commodity prices might be signalling a weaker global outlook. It might simply be an indication that equity markets had previously been overvalued and that they needed to have a correction. Or the equity price falls might in part be an irrational response to commodity price falls and other economic data, or at least they might contain an element of overreaction to genuine signals. Most likely there's an element of validity in more than one of those hypotheses, and no doubt other hypotheses could be put forward as well. As I said, I don't think it's possible to be definitive about these things at this stage, but it's relevant to note that market and media commentary often errs on the side of being too gloomy. And to counterbalance that, to some extent, I think a few points can and should be made. First of all, as always, the recent equity price movements have to be put in perspective. This isn't the first bout of nervousness that we've seen in these markets. In the advanced economies, there was a similar one late last year from which markets subsequently recovered, and the recent declines reverse only a small part of the cumulative gains that have taken place during the post-crisis recovery period. Second point, there seems to have been relatively little new economic data in the early part of this year to trigger a major reassessment of the global outlook. And even though the Chinese economy has been slowing, it's still growing at a reasonable rate. And third, the hypothesis that falling equity and falling oil prices are interrelated responses to a weakening in the global outlook seems hard to sustain. The falls in oil prices seem to be driven mainly by strong supply, not by weak demand. And consistent with that, other non-energy commodity prices have been relatively stable during this recent period when oil prices have continued to fall. This observation, I think, has important implications for the general outlook. An oil supply expansion could be expected to put downward pressure on oil prices and to have a range of complicated effects on producers, consumers, and holders of energy assets. But it would normally be considered to be a net positive for the world as a whole. I think these points argue against putting an excessive focus on recent market movements, but that said, there are clearly signs of increased volatility around the world in recent times and a heightened focus on financial risks. So we need to keep a watchful eye on that as that unfolds. Now I want to turn to my second broad theme, which is the implications of the global risk environment for Australia. Direct exposures of Australian banking institutions to the risk factors that I've been describing are quite limited, and a good summary indicator of that comes up in my next table. This is showing you exposures of Australian banks to developments offshore. So effectively it's showing their international lending and other assets as a proportion of their overall assets. The thing to focus on here is the far right-hand column, so it's showing you their international assets as a proportion of their total assets, and if you look down the bottom there, you see that their total offshore assets are about 24% of total banking assets. So it's relatively small even in total, and I think you can see from the detail reading up the table that it's well diversified and not particularly concentrated in what we might consider to be the high risk areas that I've been talking about before, like Greece and the euro area. In fact, the largest single exposures are in New Zealand, which are the Australian bank operations and branch operations in New Zealand. So the offshore exposures are not particularly high and definitely not high in the high risk areas, and they're well diversified. As a more general observation, Australian banks have increased their resilience over recent years in a number of other respects, responding both to market expectations and to supervisory actions. Notably, they've raised their capital ratios and they've shifted their funding structures to make them more resilient to financial market disruptions. Of course, none of this guarantees that Australian banks will be immune to international shocks in the future, but it does suggest that the main effects from the risks that I've been describing are likely to be indirect, working through the impact of factors like commodity prices, trade flows and confidence on the broader Australian economy. Now that brings me to the third part of our risk assessment, which is domestically generated sources of risk. Here our analysis has for some time focused on the buoyancy seen in parts of the property market and the leverage associated with that. Much of the focus has been on residential property, and I'll start with some comments on that before turning to the commercial sector, where risks have also been growing. Although the housing market hasn't been universally strong around the country, we have seen a period of significant strength in the Sydney and Melbourne markets in recent times, with investors playing a big role in that. We're now seeing some easing in those pressures, which I'll describe in a moment, but to summarise a few of the key facts, housing prices in Sydney reached a peak annual rate of increase of 18% in mid-2015. In Melbourne, the peak rate of increase was 14% around the same time. And as an indicator of the very strong role played by the investor segment of the market, the value of loan approvals to investors in New South Wales approximately doubled over the 2 years to mid-2015. As a result of those sorts of developments, household debt has been rising and the ratio of debt to income has been edging up from a level that was already high. And you can see that illustrated in the next chart. If you focus on the top right-hand part of the chart, the household debt to income ratio is now about 150% and starting to rise. That said, we should also recognise that the other risk metrics shown in the chart are somewhat more benign than that. But it's against this background that I've laid out that the Reserve Bank has highlighted the need for prudence and has supported APRA and ASIC in the various measures that they've taken over the past few years to strengthen lending standards. As a general proposition, mortgage lending standards in the post-crisis period have been tighter than they were pre-crisis. Low-doc loans are rare. Genuine savings are required to fund at least part of the deposit, and the application of interest rate buffers in serviceability assessments for home loans has become widespread. Nevertheless, investigations by APRA and ASIC during 2015 showed that there had been some slipping in lending standards and that they were inadequate in some important respects to the current risk environment. Specifically, APRA found that in some instances, lenders' serviceability assessments were based on over-optimistic judgments about the reliability of borrowers' incomes or inadequate estimates of borrowers' living expenses, or that they failed to take into account the possible effects of future interest rate movements on a borrower's existing debt commitments. ASIC similarly conducted a review of lending practices for interest-only lending, and they made some similar findings. Furthermore, as a result of the additional scrutiny over the past year or so and substantial data revisions made by the banks, we now know that the level of investor activity in the housing market was in fact higher than previously thought. As we've highlighted in our recent financial stability reviews, a high level of investor activity can add to the level of financial risks associated with residential markets. As you know, APRA announced a number of supervisory measures in December 2014 to strengthen mortgage lending standards. These measures included expectations that banks shouldn't be increasing their share of high-risk lending in their portfolios, that the growth of investor lending shouldn't be material above 10%, and that appropriate interest rate floors and buffers should be applied in serviceability assessment tests. In response, we have seen significant tightening in lending standards over the course of 2015. Interest rate floors and buffers at banks have increased and become more uniform across the sector. The level of high-risk lending has declined, and most notably, lending with loan-to-valuation ratios greater than 90% has come down. And the pace of investor lending growth has also slowed significantly in response to those various actions. You can see that in this next chart, with lending to investors now growing at a rate of about 6% compared to rates of well over 10% at the end of 2014. At the same time, we've seen accelerated lending to owner-occupiers, so that the overall growth of lending to housing has stayed roughly the same, but we've seen a change in the mix towards what would appear to be a less risky portfolio. The next main area of risk focused domestically has been in commercial property, and historically this sector has been a common source of financial instability both here and abroad. During the height of the GFC, Australian banks remained in comparatively good shape, but they did suffer a noticeable deterioration in asset performance, with their aggregate non-performance rates rising to just under 2% of loans. A significant part of that deterioration was in commercial property, and impaired commercial property exposures accounted for about 30% of Australian banks' non-performing assets at that time. Having gone through a post-crisis downturn, the commercial property sector is again experiencing strong investor demand, and bank lending to the sector is increasing, and there are a number of signs of increasing risk associated with all of that. We can see some aspect of that in the next chart. Trends in commercial property prices and rents have been diverging over the past few years, with prices continuing to rise while rents in the sector have been flat to down. As a result, yields have declined, and this is all happening at a time when vacancy rates in commercial property have been increasing. As was the case for the housing market, conditions haven't been uniform across the country, and they've been noticeably firmer in Sydney and Melbourne than in other cities. But the major commercial property markets around the country have all seen downward pressure on yields over recent years. Strong demand from foreign buyers has contributed to this, reflecting the global environment of low interest rates and search for yield. Overall, the risks appear manageable at this stage, but they underscore the need for sound lending practices and for appropriate prudence by investors. I'm going to sum up now, and to return to my original theme, the Reserve Bank has a long-standing mandate for financial stability. It was affirmed, for example, as part of the Wallace reforms as far back as 1998. In the post-Wallace world, the bank's financial stability function hasn't mainly been about regulation, even though we do have some regulatory powers in some areas, but it goes well beyond that. It includes the bank's role as liquidity manager for the financial system and as a provider and operator of core payments infrastructure, and it also includes our coordinating role in chairing the Council of Financial Regulators. One other important component of our financial stability work, which is the one I've focused on today, is the provision of timely risk analysis to help inform the policy debate and also to help inform the decisions of lenders and investors. I've given you a summary of our latest analysis today. I hope you'll find that helpful in informing your own investment decisions. And with that, I thank you for your attention and I wish you every success.
Thank you very much. An excellent presentation. I was registered to attend the Basel Risk Committee last year, and together we brought the capital raising requirements for the bank down from $40 billion to $20 billion, leaving money in the economy for the investors. Is the Basel Committee, which does not evaluate the effect of their requirements, a risk for the Australian economy?
Thanks for that question. The Basel Committee is doing a lot of work on a lot of different fronts, and mainly what they're about is strengthening standards for banking. So that includes things like strengthening capital and liquidity standards. So banks are now being required to hold more capital overall and to have better liquidity management. And there's a whole raft of things that have been done to improve the risk management framework that surrounds all of that. You did say something about evaluation of the impact of all of that, and the Basel Committee does have its own secretariat which does its own impact analysis, and they've done a lot of work trying to assess the impact of all of this work. And the general thrust of it and the direction of it has been to strengthen banks, to make them safer, make them hold more capital. Now, what APRA is doing in Australia is we don't have to slavishly follow Basel, but it is in the interests of our banking system to show that we take the international standards seriously, and APRA does take those standards very seriously, and they have a very good look at them and look at how they want to apply them here. And what APRA has done has been to do a number of different things to increase the capital requirements for banks and strengthen liquidity management requirements. Now, all of that work hasn't finished yet. We had a financial system inquiry over the course of the last couple of years which recommended that actually we go further in the same direction, and APRA is currently looking at what they might need to do that.
Thank you. Two brief questions. Does Australia, like Spain, face a prolonged period of low productivity following large foreign investments in housing and construction, as shown in the BIS study? Secondly, are you concerned by the high corporate debt growing by 80% last year? You've explained 150% for household debt to income, but government debt as 36% of GDP seems okay last year. Quick plea okay. to lower the Australian dollar as fast as you can.
I'm going to focus mainly on the second one of those questions because I haven't seen the particular study that you're referring to, but it was a question that referred to really the general economic outlook and prospects. And I think the main observation that I would want to make there is that overall, even though people might express dissatisfaction about the level of growth that we're getting, overall, the Australian economy has done very well in the post-crisis environment. We didn't have a recession, we didn't have a banking crisis, and we've emerged from all of that in good shape. So I think that's the point that I would want to emphasise there. Now, the second part of your question was focusing on corporate debt, and it is true that corporate borrowing now is rising faster than it had been, but that's from a position where the corporate sector had significantly deleveraged in the post-crisis environment. So if you compare it with the household sector, for example, basically the way the household sector responded to the crisis was to increase their savings and to be more cautious in the way they spent money, but they didn't actually reduce debt very much relative to their incomes. They more or less held the level about the same. And now, as I pointed out in the talk, we've reached a stage in the cycle where they're starting to increase debt again. But corporates actually were quite proactive in the post-crisis environment in deleveraging, and they therefore, I think, do have plenty of scope to borrow more, to invest more. I think one of the comments that's often made about the Australian economy in the current situation is that we're in an adjustment phase post the mining boom, so miners are investing less, and we would actually like to see the non-mining sector investing more, and that may well involve borrowing more to invest. So I don't think that's a particular area of concern at the moment.
I'd just like to ask a question about the cutting of interest rates, which of course is in the Reserve Bank sphere. Obviously, the interest rates have been cut quite dramatically in order to stimulate spending. However, when an interest rate cut is announced and the Reserve Bank itself says that may cut again, or commentators get in and say, we expect three more cuts this year, that cut becomes null and void because people are not going to invest now because they think it'll be cheaper later on. I don't know what the Reserve Bank can do about this, but do you have any ideas yourself?
That's a very difficult one because, as you know, there's no shortage of people speculating about what the next interest rate move is going to be. And I often joke before I come to these talks that I hope I don't make a career-ending gaffe. And one of the ways that I could do that would be to make a prediction about interest rates. So I'm not going to do that. I think the main thing I think to say about interest rates is a low interest rate environment is more supportive of spending and investment than a high interest rate environment. Rates are now a lot lower than they were a few years ago, and they're well below average. So I think that gross observation should be telling you that we have an environment that is supporting spending and growth. But I don't want to get into specifics about how you manage the process of predicting rate moves. There are plenty of other people that will be talking about that in due course. I'll take that as a comment and not respond to it.
Dr. Eady, I gained the impression from your talk, which was fascinating, that you're quite comfortable with the way that the banks in Australia are structured at the moment. I raise this because the other day I was listening to the radio, and perhaps other people were as well, and admittedly it was coming from a broker in the UK. But he was implying that the risks that the banks of default, effectively, I think he was sort of implying, were very similar to those in Europe, which surprised me, and I'd just like to like you to comment on that.
Well, I haven't seen the specific comment that you're referring to, and so it's better if I just try and comment about the strength of the banking system in the aggregate. I think the important reality is that the Australian banks are well capitalised and they have good asset quality. There are a number of different ways that you can measure that, and I referred to a couple of them on the way through in the talk today. Non-performing loans are low. APRA has a very proactive approach to risk management in the banking sector, and I think that was shown to have served us well during the crisis environment when we avoided the sort of crisis that occurred in other countries. So I think the main thing I can say about all of that is that I'm confident that our banks are in good shape and that the supervisors are being very proactive in making sure that banks adhere to sound management practices.
I just wanted to ask, everyone's saying now that we should get into agriculture, you know, because we have clean food and China has not food, and I see it with the A2 milk, etc. Do you think that we're going to sort of get back to like our new resource is going to be clean food or agriculture? And of course that has other complications, because if you have a drought or a flood, do you think that sector of the market's going to increase?
Well, that's a very hard one for me to answer, I'm afraid, because I'm not really in a position to make predictions about particular sectors. I'm not saying it's not a good question, but I'm probably not the right person to be asking that one. I'll have to pass on that one.
Thank you for your talk. In a similar vein, given we've reached 24 million people and given the infrastructure audit and the plan released yesterday, is it a good time to be investing in infrastructure, of which there's some quite significant infrastructure gaps in Australia in general, and particularly in New South Wales?
Well, I think I'd revert to my earlier observation, just to try and keep it reasonably safe, and say that we are in a post-resources boom environment, and the Reserve Bank has made the comment on a number of occasions that this should be an environment where we would like to see more investment in other sorts of activities, and I think that does include infrastructure. And, you know, one of the drivers of investment demand is population growth, because the more population you've got, the more infrastructure you need, the more people you have to employ, and the more demand there is for the products that businesses are producing, and so they need more capacity to produce more output. So logically, this should be an environment where people are willing to invest in a whole range of things, and the interest rate structure is low. That should be supporting that. That's one of the things that we've been saying for quite a while.
So you may choose to pass on this question too, but as a person who's lived in the country for quite a part of my life, many of us are concerned about the country, in particular those who work very hard in the country. Have you any comment to make on how we could, as the term goes, move forward in that area? Because we see, as investors and those who watch the market, an absence of real hope for those who are in the country. Thank you.
That's another difficult one, I'm afraid. I don't like refusing to answer questions, but sometimes things get asked that are outside my portfolio, and I've got some sympathy with the Chinese governor who I quoted earlier, saying that we're not gods and magicians who can do everything. And really, the role of the Reserve Bank is to focus on the system as a whole rather than the allocation of resources within the system, and we try as much as we can to stick to that. There may be someone out there who can give you hope. I'm just saying that I'm not that person.
So there's not a voice in the Reserve Bank that is
Well, there are plenty of people that are studying developments in the rural sector.
If the Greek financial crisis is over, why? And if it's not over, what might trigger the next problem?
That's another very good question. Is the crisis over? It's hard to answer that because what's your definition of crisis? I think the way I think I'd like to answer it is to say we're still being affected by the 08-09 crisis. That was really the theme of my speech. It's 7 to 8 years since the crisis hit, and we're still grappling with the after effects of it, and there are still vulnerabilities that we have to grapple with. So I think that's the answer without saying one way or the other what you call the situation is that we're in. That's what it is. And I think part of what's going on in the early part of this year is that some of those uncertainties that were still hanging over us are coming back to the surface. Markets are evaluating, are we really on a track that's going to resolve all of these difficulties, or is there further work to be done? So that kind of re-evaluation is still going on at the moment. But I think, having said all of that, I also want to emphasise another thing which I also tried to bring out in the speech, which is that the market turmoil that we've seen this year doesn't seem to have been triggered by anything in particular in terms of observable fundamentals. If you look at the flow of economic data that's come out since the start of the year, you'd be hard-pressed to find something that is going to generate and explain the kind of turmoil that we've seen. So what that suggests to me is it's too early yet to tell whether what the markets are doing is really signalling something that's really happening, or whether it's just a bit of irrational froth, or even whether it itself becomes a force that starts to affect other parts of the global economy. I think it's still too early to evaluate all of that.
Some commentators are becoming alarmed at the increase in government debt. I just wonder if you've got a comment to make on that.
Well, I think the general comment to make about government debt is that for many, many years, Australia has been a low debt country as far as government debt is concerned, and that is still the case. If you do a league table of countries that have got high levels of government debt, we don't feature in that. So when people express concern about government debt in Australia, what they're really talking about is the fact that it's rising rather than the fact that it's high. And I think the implication of that is that over time there needs to be a strategy to deal with that, but it needs to be put in the perspective of the fact that the overall level is quite low.
Is it the question's been asked? Something next?
Hi, just following on from what you said a couple of answers ago. A lot of the commentary I read suggests that the turmoil that's going on in the markets at the moment is actually a reflection of a loss of investors' confidence in central banks, particularly overseas, not necessarily here. Given the fact that we've got a world awash with debt, much more debt than existed back in the GFC, how do you see that situation unfolding, devolving, if we use the title of your play on the title of your talk? Do you see it happening in an orderly fashion? Is it going to be chaotic? And in either instance, to bring it back to why we're here, how would you recommend we position our portfolios?
Well, I think you know I'm not going to make any portfolio recommendations. I think that the best answer that I can give is really along the lines of an answer that I gave to a previous question, and also to what I said in the talk, which is that there are various different interpretations that can be put on the market turmoil we've seen this year, ranging from it's no big deal to it's an irrational reaction to something that's not really real, to it's really signalling something but we haven't observed the full implications of it yet. I think that it would be conveying a false sense of certainty if I made predictions or strong statements about how we should interpret that. But the main point that I tried to get across today is don't automatically swing to the most pessimistic interpretation, because that's what you'll see in a lot of the media commentary. There's a kind of a knee-jerk tendency to be as pessimistic as possible, and there are various things that should be kept in mind to keep this in perspective. And one of those is there just hasn't been very much movement in observable fundamentals to justify the sorts of things that we've seen in the markets so far this year. Well, I grant you that debt in quite a number of economies is still high, and I said that earlier, but the point I'm making just now is that that hasn't changed very much just in the recent period, and in fact those debt ratios in a number of instances have been coming down and people have been repairing their balance sheets, so there's no particular trigger that you can identify in the early part of this year to have generated what we've seen so far this year.
Ladies and gentlemen, we've heard a very wide-ranging and well-documented presentation today from Malcolm, and I'll ask you to put your hands together. Thank you.